Epilogue. Jason stared at the result in disbelief. He could feel the combined attention of everyone in the room as the data from Wynn's search through the library's records flowed down the holopad in front of him. Listed was every system that had gained a planet in the last 60 years. Saba and Danny had already examined most of them during their search of CEDF's files, and the rest had turned out to be either ordinary planetary acquisitions or fleeting encounters with the living planet. All told, there were 15 acquisitions and a further 40 encounters. But unfortunately, and frustratingly, each of them could be ruled out. Jason shook his head in dismay. "It's not here."
"It has to be here," Mara said. "There's nowhere else it could have gone."
"Unless it's hiding somewhere in the rest of the galaxy," Luke said wearily.
"But we'd know about it if it was," Mara said.
"Perhaps we just haven't looked hard enough. It might be in one of the smaller backwaters, like the Minos cluster, for instance."
"Or maybe it left the galaxy altogether."
Danny's voice was heavy with gloom. "Or perhaps it just died." "No," Jason said. "It didn't die. We have hollows of it around two of the systems it visited, remember?" Jason was finding it hard to keep the frustration from his voice. "And it can't have left the galaxy either, not unless it knows something about hyperspace that we don't." "Or it's found a way to exist without a sun," Luke put in. Jason shook his head. "I refuse to accept any of those possibilities."
"Then what are you going to do?"
Fells was the voice of cold reason. "If you've looked and you haven't found it, and you've ruled out every other possibility, then where does that leave you? Perhaps Zonama Seacoat really is nothing but a legend." "No," Jason said firmly. "No, I can't believe that either. Verger wouldn't have lied to me."
"Can you be absolutely sure of that?"
"Yes." Jason met the one-eyed stare of the assistant syndic with stubborn determination. "Yes, I can. Zonama Seacoat is real. All we have to do is find it." He turned back to the hologram. "Somehow."
"Well, you now have the support of the houses if you want to continue looking in Chiss space," Fell said.
Jason felt exhausted. His uncle's hand came to rest on his shoulder, reassuring him. Saba and Mara brushed minds with his to offer their support, too. He was grateful for the gestures, but he was unable to silence the doubt that Suntir Fell had given voice to. What if Verger had lied to him? What if Zonama Seacoat was just a dream? From far away, almost a quarter rotation around the galaxy, he sensed Jaina's capitulation to exhaustion at the completion of her duty. He occasionally felt flashes of his twin sister, even from so far away. It felt good, he thought, and wished he could do the same. He'd barely slept since arriving on Scylla, and it was getting so that he couldn't think straight anymore. His body felt weak, hollow and fragile, and had it not been for the Force propping him up, he was sure he would have collapsed into himself hours ago. But despite the aid of the Force, he knew he was going to have to rest eventually. Staring dully at the data, even if he did it forever and a day, wasn't going to surrender any answers. "Right or wrong," he said, standing, "you're going to have to try to find it without me for a while, I'm afraid. I need to rest." Without another word, he brushed past his aunt and left the room, ignoring the concerned look from Commander Irolia as he walked deep into the aisles of the library. Danny came to him half an hour later. He had tucked himself in a corner at the library's uppermost level. It was peaceful there, uncomplicated, the perfect place to clear his head.
"Hey."
She eased herself next to him and leaned against the wall. They sat side by side in silence, their legs gently touching. He felt he should say something, but he simply didn't know how to express what he was feeling.
"You know," she said after a long silence he barely noticed, "I had another thought."
He half turned to her. "About Zonama Seacoat?" She nodded.
"What if it broke apart? The stress of all that jumping must have taken its toll. Worlds are pretty fragile, after all. One slip-up could have cracked it wide open, and we never actually looked for new asteroid belts. Jason acknowledged her suggestion with a polite nod, but he didn't really credit it. He couldn't afford to. Sonoma Seacoat was out there. It had to be. There had to be something lurking in the data that he'd overlooked, or something he hadn't yet looked for.
"Are you angry with me?"
Danny said hesitantly.
"Huh?"
The question startled him from his thoughts.
"Angry with you? Why would you think that?"
She shrugged.
"You don't seem to want to talk to me, that's all."
"No, I'm not angry, Danny. I'm just tired. I haven't slept properly. I came up here to think things through."
"Things?"
she prompted.
"You mean Sonoma Seacoat kind of things?"
He nodded, grinning. "Sonoma Seacoat kind of things."
"I've been thinking about things, too," she said. "Us kind of things."
"Really?"
She nodded once, turning her gaze briefly onto the vast expanse of books spread out before them, as if searching for the words that might best convey her thoughts.
"It's strange, you know. I can crack the biological secrets of the Yuuzhan Vong. I can plot the likelihood of a solar system capturing a new planet. But sometimes I can't even begin to guess what goes on inside your head, Jason Solo."
He took her hand.
"Danny, I..." "No. Let me finish. We've known each other for a few years now, since the beginning of the war, when you rescued me from Helska IV. But it wasn't until that day on Mester Reef that I saw you for who you are. Not as one of the Solos, or a Jedi Knight, or Jaina's brother, but as you. And I liked what I saw."
Jason remembered that day well. The variety of life in and around the coral, the green of Danny's eyes and the brownness of her skin, the promise in her smile.
"You're strong," she said. "It may surprise you to know that I think you're the strongest person in the entire Galactic Alliance. You're the only one with the courage to question what everyone else regards as a great privilege. Most people would happily accept the honor of being a Jedi Knight, but you don't. You look beneath the honor and try to understand what it means to be a Jedi. That sort of strength can't be taught, Jason. It comes from within." "And you're kind," she went on. "No, look at me," she said when he turned away, beginning to feel awkward. "This is stuff you need to hear. In the middle of a war, it's hard sometimes to remember the good things. People are rewarded for being great fighters, but rarely for exhibiting gentler strengths, such as kindness and compassion, or the kind of loyalty that questions rather than accepts. Your sister gets all the medals, while you fade into the background."
"The medals don't interest me," he said, "and I certainly don't begrudge Jaina getting them."
"I know that,"
she interrupted.
"You would never resent anyone for her success. That's just another of your strengths."
She paused, smiling.
"Shall I go on?"
He shook his head, smiling also.
"I think I get the idea. Jason, I'm not saying this to embarrass you, or to prompt you into saying something similar in return. Don't ever think that. I'm saying it because I think you need to hear it."
"Why?"
"Because to you, success depends solely upon finding Sonoma Seacoat. I understand that, and I understand its importance in the greater scheme of things, but there's a smaller scheme, too, one that I feel you've already succeeded in. After years of crossing each other's paths like some wandering satellites, I'm glad that I'm finally close enough to you to be able to say that you've grown into a man I'd be proud to call a friend."
Her gaze held his, its intensity matched only by the seriousness of what she was saying. She stopped there, with a gentle squeeze of his hand that told him it was his turn to speak. He knew he had to say something in return, regardless of whether or not he felt comfortable doing so. He sensed that she was talking about more than friendship, and he wasn't sure how to define his feelings in return. He vividly remembered the day he had rescued her from Helska IV. She had seemed so beautiful to him, so much older and more mature, and utterly unobtainable. He may have rescued her from the Yuuzhan Vong, but at the end of that day, he had been just a boy and she was a woman. And he still carried a measure of that impression with him. Although he was with her now, talking as equals, the young boy in him remained at a distance, unable to believe that anything else could be true. Like some wandering satellites. He was about to try to explain his feelings to her when her phrase returned to him. The words were niggling at his thoughts, demanding attention. For some reason, her use of the metaphor troubled him, but not because of what it meant to him. It made him think of the fruitless quest Vergere had sent him on, although it wasn't immediately apparent why her simple words caused this reaction in him. Satellites? As far as he was aware, Zonama Seacoat didn't have any satellites. In fact, he doubted it could have even kept one with all the hyperspace jumps it had performed. Perhaps it had acquired one since. Then the answer struck him in one blinding flash. It was so obvious he could have kicked himself. Consumed by the inspiration, he completely forgot about Danny and their conversation. Afraid of losing any more time, of missing an opportunity, he abruptly stood up. "Jason?" Danny said, her expression puzzled as her hand fell back into her lap. "What?" "I've got it!" The exclamation came out with a laugh. "Come on, Danny, let's go!" He hurried down the stairs, heading back to the ground level and the massive pile of books they had sorted through. He was vaguely aware of Danny running behind him, calling out for him to stop and asking what was wrong. But there simply wasn't enough time to stop and explain. She would have to hear what he had to say when he told the others. Everyone looked up when he ran to the table. Danny was only a few seconds behind him, her look of confusion reflecting the expressions of the others. "We need to run another search," he said breathlessly as he stepped up to Wynne. His uncle was the first to respond. "Another search? But, Jason, we've already searched every planet in the not for planets," Jason interrupted. "For moons." Luke crinkled his brow at this. "Why would we do that?" "Think about it," he said breathlessly. "If Zonama Seacoat entered a system around a gas giant, it wouldn't show us a world, would it? It'd be registered as a satellite, just like Yavin 4, a habitable world in a habitable zone. But it would be listed as a moon. Don't you see? We would have missed it." "But Jason," Danny said from behind him, "the tidal forces of entering such a configuration would be incredibly severe." He dismissed her protest with a wave of his hand. "I'm sure Zonama Seacoat could find a way around that, just as it always found a way to escape whenever it needed to. It's resourceful and determined." He faced his uncle, wanting the Jedi Master to believe him. "I know I'm right about this. We have to do the search." His uncle thought about it for a long moment, and then turned to Wynne. "Will it take long?" The girl looked nervous at being the sudden focus of such attention.
"That depends on how many possible targets there are." "There probably wouldn't be too many," Danny said. "System captures are scarce enough as it is, but the acquisition of extrasolar world-sized moons by gas giants would be extremely rare. I'd be amazed to find even one in the last 100 years. The odds of it happening in a system's habitable zone are minute."
"Could Jason be right, then?" Mara asked.
Danny studied Jason critically, then shrugged and smiled.
"I guess there's only one way to find out."
Jason sent a wave of warm gratitude in her direction. The look of rage on Shimra's face was the most satisfying thing Numenor had ever seen. Even from a distance, and viewed through a Vilip beacon concealed in N'Gala's robes, it thrilled him to the core of his black heart.
"Tell me again," Shimra said in the tight, too-controlled manner that presaged an explosion of anger.
how your incompetence led to the fugitive's escape.
Yes, Dreadlord. Taking a deep breath, the commander, Hrevin Karsh, repeated almost word for word his explanation of how his warriors had allowed a small and relatively helpless party of Jedi and Imperials to slip through their fingers in the unknown regions. Numenor was coming into the story late, but it appeared as though this party, led by the Skywalkers, had been instrumental in foiling an operation that should have taken the insular but fiercely militaristic nation known as the Imperial Remnant out of the picture altogether. From there, they had moved into the unknown regions. Karsh, sent by the leader of the attack on the Imperial Remnant, had tracked the mission from a distance, but lost them on the edge of Chiss space. The present whereabouts of the Skywalkers remained, much to Karsh's embarrassment and chagrin, unknown. Hrevin Karsh was an inexperienced commander. His relative, Kom Karsh, had died trying to obtain information from the abominable libraries on Abroa Sky, and he had slipped into the empty shoes with ambitious relish. His ritual modifications, Vondune crab armor plates inserted under his skin and coaxed to grow and overlap at odd angles so that his skin took on the appearance of a buckled, jagged crust, had been conducted in haste. The wounds, in fact, were still weeping. But the discomfort they would have caused was nothing compared to the indignity he must have felt at having to detail his failure to the Supreme Overlord, nor to the punishment that would inevitably follow. "We are presently combing the fringes of the Chiss Empire for any sign of the fugitives, and combing?" the Supreme Overlord interrupted, descending with menace from his spiny, blood-red throne of Yorick coral. His scarred, slashed, tattooed face twisted into a sneer. The macaque implants in his eye sockets burned with an all-too-familiar glare. "Did you say combing?" Karsh swallowed uneasily as the Supreme Overlord approached with careful, calculated steps. "I did, Great One." There was no mistaking it for anything but an apology. "What are you, Karsh? The handmaiden of some infidel princess?" Shimra snarled out his words barely centimeters from the commander's face. "My lord, no, I only meant—" "We are the Yuuzhan Vong, Karsh. We do not comb. We take. This galaxy and everything in it belongs to us, including the worlds in the unknown regions. You will remind the Chiss of that fact. If they are harboring the fugitives you seek, then you will not let their borders hinder you, nor will you pander to their delusions of grandeur. You will put them in their place, and you shall do so by taking what is rightfully ours, not by combing delicately through that which the Chiss mistakenly believe to be their own. Do I make myself clear?" "Yes, Supreme One." Karsh stiffened in resolve. "I assure you that the Jedi will be found. I swear it on my domain's name." His tone had lost its frightened edge. He sounded more relieved that the audience with Shimra seemed to be drawing to a close. If he was lucky, he might yet walk away from this meeting unscathed. With the luxury of distance from Shimra's wrath, Numenor knew better. By sending Karsh into the unknown regions, Shimra had effectively sacrificed the commander in a gambit that would do nothing more than antagonize another enemy. "Excellent, Karsh. Excellent." Returning to his throne, Shimra sat and faced the commander one more time. "Now, come to me and give me your hand." Karsh did so, climbing the steps nervously to Shimra and extending one scarred, clawed hand. The Supreme Overlord looked the commander in the eye and smiled. "No," he said, resting back in his black and gray robes. "Sever it, and give it to me. I will keep it
As a reminder of your promise, should you fail me again, I shall sacrifice each and every member of your domain to the gods. Is that understood?
Karsh nodded tensely, understanding all too well that Shimra meant precisely what he said. Taking a sharp-edged kufi from the scabbard at his side, he raised it with one hand and, with a blank expression on his face, neatly sliced off the other. The severed limb fell with a heavy thud to the floor. A patter of light footsteps came as the bent, mutilated figure of Shimra's familiar capered forward to collect it while Karsh stood rigidly to attention. Shimra waited a long moment as Karsh's lifeblood spilled out onto the ground, splashing his boots. Then he nodded his approval to the commander.
"You may go."
Karsh walked stiffly to the exit. The view was perfectly clear in the villip. At last, Numenor had exactly what he needed, an insight into Shimra's inner sanctuary, an ear to the Yuuzhan'vong leader's words and thoughts. Things were clearly not going well for the Supreme Overlord. The lack of advancement since taking Yuuzhan'tar seemed to have afflicted the entire Yuuzhan'vong force. Resistance had formed where previously there was none. Supply lines had been sabotaged. Terraforming of the capital world was at a standstill, and the priests warned incessantly of the tightening hold of heresy on the lower ranks. This last part pleased Numenor the most. His efforts had sent a tide of dissent lapping at the walls of Shimra's stronghold. Numenor's satisfaction deepened as the conversation in Shimra's throne room moved to other matters. He could hear every word perfectly. Attacking N'Gala had turned out to be the best thing he could have done. Far from making the priestess fear him, it seemed to have bolstered her resolve to defy the Supreme Overlord.
"I owe you my life, master," N'Gala had gasped up at him from where she had lain on the floor the day they had met under their new circumstances. She had been weak and pale, but gradually regaining her strength. The antidote Numenor had administered was slowly taking effect.
"You are truly Yusha, the compassionate one, and I am your humble servant."
Numenor recognized an opportunity when he saw one, and he had no reservations in exploiting one when it came his way. "I have given you back your life," he had said to the priestess. "With what are you prepared to repay me?"
"I would repay you with my life, my master."
"You would willingly risk it for me?"
"Without hesitation, my master."
"And if I were to ask you to risk it for the Jedi?"
"If you were to ask me to risk it for a Gazakal worm, I would do so without question," N'Gala had said. "But for the Jedi, I would gladly offer my life in sacrifice, so that I might again become one with the Force."
Numenor remembered N'Gala's words distinctly. It was a conclusion that hadn't come from him or his followers, but rather something N'Gala had devised herself. Over subsequent days, as the priestess slowly regained her strength, Numenor had probed for the source of this and other conclusions N'Gala had come to before deciding to seek out the prophet for herself. It transpired that N'Gala had had contact with the treacherous creature Verger, who had sowed the seeds of doubt in her mind while in the safekeeping of the deception sect. N'Gala had been doubting the established pantheon for some time since, and had been seeking a way to incorporate the Jedi and the Force into the worldview she'd been brought up to accept. Some of the priestess's conclusions echoed Numenor's fictitious propositions, such as the idea of the Force being an echo of the spirit of Yun Yuuzhan, but others were truly her own. The idea that death reunited the Yuuzhan'vong with the spirit of their creator was, in Numenor's opinion, an inspired one, and one that allowed him to offer the shamed ones an excuse to risk their lives in his service. As someone well acquainted with deception and deceit, she had tracked the prophet's message to its source and, by virtue of her sincerity, had inveigled herself among the acolytes. Numenor was not so naive as to take the priestess's servitude at face value. He knew there was a possibility that N'Gala was a double agent, emptily spouting the words she knew Numenor wanted to hear.
Nevertheless, the opportunity to send N'Gala back to Shimra, equipped with a Vilip beacon, was one too perfect to turn down. "Marked downturn in the Far Reach's destabilization program," a subaltern was saying. "The infiltration phase is complete in many rival communities, with conflict escalating to the point of open war in others. But in at least two major instances, the infidels have intervened to halt our work. In both cases, the work of our agents was not just undone, but ultimately used to strengthen the infidels. I fear that this counteracts the successful work achieved in other areas." "This was the program initiated by Numanor, was it not?" an aide asked. "If so, do not speak that name in my presence!" Shimra interrupted sharply, standing. Then, with more composure but no humor at all, he smiled. "Not until I have his severed head before me, and I wear his flayed skin as a cloak, will I hear the traitor's name again." The Supreme Overlord's macaquet implants burned like miniature suns. "You will do well to remember that. Otherwise, it will be your head I shall have before me." The aide backed away. "Yes, most potent and powerful one. I simply wish to point out that the fact that this program is the work of a certain former executor might explain its failure. It was flawed to begin with, my lord, and perhaps, therefore, should be abandoned." "No," Shimra said thoughtfully, descending the steps of his throne. "It was a good plan when it was proposed, and it is still a good plan. We will continue with the program for the time being. It is an effective use of resources in a region far from the main front. Any temporary alliances formed as a result of the incompetence of our agents will be corrected when the rest of the galaxy has fallen." As the subaltern retreated into anonymity, Numanor told himself that he should be feeling satisfaction, not hurt. Shimra's acknowledgment of his destabilization plan was the highest praise he had ever received from the Supreme Overlord. It was nice to know that, reviled as he was, his skills were at least appreciated. But to hear himself dismissed as a certain former executor was galling. "What news of the heretics?" Shimra asked. High Priest Jakan glided reverently forward. "Our spies have failed to penetrate the inner command circle," he said. "Our lack of knowledge of their doctrine is too great, their loyalty too strong."
"Loyalty? To what?"
"To their leader, great lord. He is the one from whom this heresy springs."
"And what is his name, this so-called leader of shamed ones?"
"He is called Yusha, the prophet."
"A prophet?"
Shimra offered a short, menacing laugh.
"Does he see things, this prophet? Things that are to be?"
"So it is said, great lord."
"And does he see his own death, I wonder?"
The high priest did not say anything to this, nor did Shimra expect a response. The Supreme Overlord clenched one gnarled fist and raised it in the air for all to see.
"I want him destroyed. Do you hear me? I want him found and destroyed. I want him crushed, along with all of those who follow him."
"It will not be easy," N'Gala announced evenly, disguising the voice of her heart behind an intelligence report. Claiming information gleaned through the work of her sect, she had persuaded the priest Harar to allow her into the throne room with him. "Yusha's followers grow steadily with each day. His message spreads farther. His voice, through them, is slowly building from a whisper into a shout that will soon be too loud to silence." Shimra turned on her, a mask of cold anger. From the steadiness of the image he was watching, Numanor knew that N'Gala neither flinched nor trembled as the Supreme Overlord approached her.
"And what is it they will be shouting, priestess?" he said.
He was so close to her now that the seared and tattooed face of Numanor's former master seemed to fill the villip.
"What is it they want?"
And Gala didn't hesitate.
They want status, highest one, to be unshamed. They want acceptance.
Shimmer's hideous visage creased in puzzlement.
Acceptance? Unshamed?
Nomanor could barely repress a cackle. He could almost read the Supreme Overlord's mind. What sort of infidel nonsense was this? The puzzlement faded. Shimmer pulled away. He was no fool. He would not mistake the ultimate goal of the heresy. The concept of redemption of the shamed ones struck at the very heart of Yuuzhan Vong hierarchy. It undermined the authority of those who stood at the top of that hierarchy. It gave a voice to those who were crushed at the bottom. On the glorious day when Numanor walked into the Supreme Overlord's throne room as the unshamed leader of a rising tide of resentment, he would look in Shimmer's eyes and stand before him as an equal. Only then would Shimmer know just how thoroughly he had lost and how triumphant Numanor had been. That a certain former executor could tunnel into the heart of the Supreme Overlord's ziggurat from its deepest basement would show everyone that he was someone to be reckoned with. His name would be accursed no longer. In a high-pitched sing-song voice, Onimi, the hideous familiar of the Supreme Overlord, spoke.
"No, my lord, they will not succeed in turning seditious dreams to deed."
Shimmer turned his attention to his familiar. "I agree that it sounds preposterous, inconceivable. But if every shamed one were to revolt, to take up arms,
numbers alone will not suffice, nor any amount of sacrifice. Night and day you are protected by guards loyal to you, prepared to die."
"Indeed," Shimmer said, scowling around the room at those attending. His thoughts, again, were obvious. On top of the shapers, intendants, and priests, who were having increasing difficulties maintaining his realm, Revan Karsh had failed him. A perfectly good plan set in place by a fugitive was beginning to fall apart, and a priestess had just delivered his death sentence. And these were the people who were supposed to protect him? No. Things most certainly were not going well for the Supreme Overlord. "Indeed," Numanor echoed with growing elation. "And if I have my way, Shimra, things are going to get a whole lot worse for you yet." When she walked into the Bokrin infirmary ward, Leia couldn't help feel as if she'd done it all before. She'd been in enough med units in her time to know that they all pretty much looked the same, and this one was no exception. However, this wasn't the source of her déjà vu. What gave this moment such a strong sense of familiarity was the patient. Tahiri lay unconscious on the room's sole bed, just as she had on Mon Calamari. The only difference was her eyes. This time, they were wide open and saw nothing. She could have been resting peacefully, but for the fierce burning of her scars. The marks left on her forehead by the Yuuzhan Vong Master Shaper on Yavin 4 seemed to flare up in response to her psychological distress. Salus Dar's meditex had found no means of easing her internal suffering. The girl made no impression in the Force, giving Leia nothing to work with. All she could do was imagine what was going on inside the young woman's mind and body. Jaina and Jag looked up from their position beside the bed. Jaina was still supposed to be confined to the hover chair the medical droid had assigned to her, but in a typical show of independence, she had discarded it within minutes of getting out of bed. Jag hadn't left her side since she'd awoken, despite the fact that he must have been as exhausted as she was. Their hands stayed firmly clasped whenever they were in range, as though they were terrified to let go for fear of losing each other again. Leia warmed at that thought. She had felt that way many times and understood it all too well. What pleased her more than anything else was the fact that Jag was slowly abandoning his reservations about open displays of affection in public. It seemed that his close encounter with Entekment had made him realize that time was simply too short to waste on worrying about what people thought.
"How's she doing?" Leia asked. "The same."
Jaina turned her attention back to Tahiri.
"She's not responding to anything they try,
and I can't get through to her. Perhaps Master Silgal could do something, but—" She shrugged helplessly. "It's like she's not even there."
They stared at the injured girl for a long moment, the gloominess of their thoughts filling the room. Then Jaina made a visible effort to change the mood, straightening and stretching her arms.
"So, has the new treaty been ratified yet? Signed and sealed?"
Leia was grateful for the change in topic. "The Puek Emancipation Movement has formally allied with Bakara. Luathen and Panib put their names to the papers half an hour ago. They've agreed to hold elections within the month, to share all Cyruvi assets seized in battle, and to initiate a liberation program for the Puek who stayed behind. My guess is, once word spreads, they'll start seeing refugees from the Imperium within months, and some sort of retaliation within a year. I hope that by then Bakara will be strong enough to stand on its own. At least they know it's coming, so they can prepare."
"What about the Kiramak?" Jag asked.
"The body is already on its way back to Ulhwek. They figure returning the body of their Grand Shrieftut will temporarily appease the Cyruvi Conclave, even if it arouses the Elders' Council. The resulting conflict should keep them occupied for a while at least."
Leia was still amazed at both the complexity and the audacity of the Kiramak's plan. Having risen to power 10 years after the decimation of the Imperium at the hands of the New Republic, it had used its unique status to formulate a reprisal that very nearly worked. Faking a Puek uprising wasn't hard. New Republic worlds responded to the idea of rebellion all too easily, so to the locals the story wasn't implausible. But nagging fear that the Puek might be as bad as their former masters could only be assuaged by reassurances from the very pinnacle of Bakaran government, and the Kiramak had found an elegant way to solve that problem.
"The droid technicians have finished analyzing Kundertal's arm," she said. Jaina's face hardened.
"And?"
"It's as you thought. He was a human replica droid."
Jag hugged Jaina lightly around the shoulders when she shuddered.
"He looked so real."
Leia nodded, understanding her daughter's revulsion. The specks of his wrist and hand matched those of the droids made by Simonel the Ingoian over 30 years ago. The bones are polyalloy, the muscles and organs are made from biofiber, his skin was grown in a clone vat, and everything else is just synth flesh. Despite it being an abomination, it's actually an incredible piece of work.
No wonder he didn't want to be examined on Salonia, Jaina said.
I didn't think such things were possible, Jag said to Leia. Imperial intelligence reported that Project Decoy failed.
It did. We never managed to get the droid brains up to scratch, although Simonel did by modifying an AA-1 verbo brain. They can be useful in certain circumstances, but by and large, they tend to be clumsy and unconvincing.
None of which applied to Kundertal, Jaina said, rubbing at her breastbone, which obviously still smarted from when the Prime Minister had attacked her.
Someone on the black market must have made progress in the last 25 years. Someone prepared to charge for their efforts, too. Long before you were born, Jaina, HRDs used to cost over 10 million credits. I can only imagine how much one would cost today.
I'm sure we'll find that out once Vyrum and Melinza have finished tracing the missing credits.
As part of a rehabilitation scheme, the two ex-activists had been co-opted by the government to demonstrate that the information they'd found earlier was genuine. Although the kidnapping charges had been overturned, Freedom had still technically been an underground operation, and some sections of the interim government wanted an assurance that they would no longer pursue illegal activities. Saul Kelly, on the other hand, had been sentenced on all manner of charges. The Rodian wasn't going to see daylight for a very long time indeed.
"So let me get this straight," Jag said, frowning. "Kundertal covertly pays someone untold millions of credits to build a replica droid of himself, right?"
Jaina nodded.
"Then he books the jaunty cavalier to pick up the droid from the manufacturer and deliver it somewhere near here. We don't know where yet. Maybe an abandoned base or a temporary station. It doesn't really matter, just as long as it's somewhere private.
Then he fakes his own kidnapping, Leia went on. This is the tricky part. He has to get off-world and back without raising suspicion. He can't take his bodyguards or his advisors. He has to be completely alone while the process is underway.
And that process was entechment. Jag's face was pale at the thought. I can't believe he voluntarily turned himself in to the Cyrook so they could suck out his soul.
Well, he must have had a good idea that they wouldn't just stick him in a droid ship and bleed him dry. He was their key to Baccarat, after all. As long as they gave him what he wanted, he would reciprocate.
You've got to admire them, really, Jaina said. The plan was actually quite brilliant. They were going to get an entire world in exchange for making Kundertal immortal, and it almost worked.
But would it have worked? Jag asked. I thought entechment wasn't permanent, that the life energy of the subject gradually decayed. Jaina nodded.
Lothan explained when we met him that they'd made significant advances in the science of entechment. That much was true, at least.
There was a Jedi student named Nikos Marr,
Leia explained, who had a similar process performed on him for medical reasons. He died with the Eye of Palpatine, so we don't know how long he would have lasted.
Kundertal wasn't a clunky droid like Nikos was, though, Jaina protested. He looked as real as you or I, and he smelled real, too. Otherwise he wouldn't have fooled Niwal and Cockmane.
Once the Cyrook had stuck him into the HRD and sent him back, all he had to do was avoid the invasion and get away. He could have dealt with any problems later, and no one would have been the wiser.
Jag shook his head. You have to feel sorry for the crew of the jaunty Cavalier. Kundertal sacrificed them all so that no one would contradict his story.
That's the sign of an evil mastermind,
Leia said, remembering her previous trip to Baccarat and her first encounter with the spirit of her father.
No price is too great to pay to ensure his own survival.
Jaina looked down to Tahiri. The girl hadn't moved throughout the conversation. Her eyes were fixed on the ceiling, their only movement the occasional blink, the regularity of which they could have set a chronometer to. That and the slow rise and fall of her chest were the only signs that she was alive at all.
"You haven't found his body," Jaina said.
"It wasn't a question," Leia replied anyway.
"No."
There was movement in the doorway. Thinking it might be a meditech come to examine Tahiri, Leia stepped aside to let them through. But it was Gaur, the Rin whom Tahiri had befriended, and a Baccarin native, a Kurtzan dressed in a sand-colored, sleeveless gray robe with a wide leather belt around his waist. Numerous pouches adorned the belt, rattling as he walked. "I apologize," the Rin said, embarrassed. "I didn't mean to intrude."
"No, please. Come in."
Jaina had told Leia the little she'd learned about the Rin from Tahiri.
"Han will be along later. I know he'll want to talk to you."
Gaur looked uncertain about this. "Oh?"
"He has a friend he hasn't heard from for a while that he thought you might know of. A Rin by the name of Droma."
"Droma." He considered the name for a moment. "It doesn't sound familiar, I'm afraid. I could probably find him for you if you like. The chances are good that one of my colleagues knows him."
"That's okay,"
Leia said.
"It's no problem. I'm sure he's doing all right wherever he is. Han was just curious, that's all."
Gaur's manner was pleasant and relaxed, perfectly likable.
"He is blessed with the same talent as my husband."
Gaur's smoky-colored forehead wrinkled at this.
"Which is?" "A knack for survival, of course."
She matched his toothy smile, then looked away. The Kurtzan was standing patiently to one side, his ridged head gleaming in the harsh hospital light. "This is Aritza," Gaur said, following her gaze. "I asked him to come."
"It's a pleasure,"
Leia said as she stepped up to the Kurtzan. She inclined her head in a slight bow of greeting.
"This is my daughter, Lieutenant Colonel Jaina Solo, and Colonel Jagged Fell."
Both nodded, and Aritza bowed in return.
"But you came to see Tahiri, I presume, not us."
Leia said, once the introductions were over.
"We came to help her, yes,"
the Kurtzen said, exchanging a look with Gower.
"Help her in what way?" Jaina asked. "The Meditechs and healers haven't been able to do anything for her. What makes you think you can?"
"They haven't been able to help her," Gower interrupted, "because they don't know what is wrong with her. They are looking for a physical ailment. They won't find one because Tahiri is not fighting a disease. She is fighting herself."
Jaina glanced at Leia, then back to Gower.
"She told you about her problem?"
"I saw enough to confirm what I had already heard. Everyone in the Rin family knows the story of the Jedi who was shaped. We know that the Yuuzhan Vong shamed ones tell it to each other as an epistle of hope. We also know that it is not encouraged outside certain circles of the Galactic Alliance. If word got out that a Jedi had been corrupted by the Yuuzhan Vong shapers, that such a thing was even possible, the growing support for the Jedi could be dramatically eroded." There was no point denying anything that Gower said.
"It's true," Leia admitted. "Meijan Quad tried to turn Tahiri into a Yuuzhan Vong warrior by giving her a new persona, that of a Yuuzhan Vong warrior called Rina. My son Anakin rescued her and managed to break the programming. We believed the new persona had been erased, but it seems more likely now that Tahiri had simply buried it."
"Not it," said Gower. "Her. Rina of Domain Quad does not want to be buried. She wants to live, as does any intelligent being. Until she's allowed that, she will not lie easily."
"She's real?" Jag asked. "She's not just a figment of Tahiri's imagination?" Lorin shook his head. "In a manner of speaking, Rina is as real as Tahiri herself. You see, Tahiri wasn't simply brainwashed to think and act like a Yuuzhan Vong. Meijan Quad designed Rina to be a person in her own right, with everything that entails. When Tahiri came back, she had more than just the knowledge of Yuuzhan Vong language and customs in her head. She had the makings of a new personality in there with her, wanting control of her body."
"But Tahiri got better," Jag said. "She was fine."
"Only until Anakin died," Leia pointed out. "Ever since then she's been struggling."
"But this Rina couldn't just have reappeared for no reason," Jag argued. "Something must have triggered her emergence."
"I agree," Gower said, "and I think that trigger was when the Galactic Alliance recently began making progress against the Yuuzhan Vong. Don't forget that when Rina came into being, her people were on the rise. She may have fallen, but so had Coruscant. So had the Senate. Her personal loss was overshadowed by the victories her compatriots were enjoying. Ultimately, I don't think she ever expected the Yuuzhan Vong to lose, as they very well might now. In the face of defeat, the spirit of the Yuuzhan Vong is fighting back. Unfortunately for Tahiri, this is taking place within rather than without, as it is for the rest of us."
"So how do we get rid of her?"
Jaina asked, her eyes shining with tears. Leia knew that Jaina felt responsible for Tahiri's breakdown and injuries on Bakura. She had suspected Rina's presence on Galantos, but hadn't known back then what to do.
"There's only one way to be sure of doing that," Gower said.
"And that is?" Jaina pressed.
Lorin fixed her with an even and calculating stare. "To kill Tahiri, of course."
"What?"
Jaina's voice was cold and angry.
"Don't even think of joking about something like this. Is no joke, I assure you."
Lorin's tail quivered with repressed energy. "The basic mistake everyone in this room is making is assuming Rina to be something that can be simply excised from Tahiri. However, Rina isn't some kind of tumor. She's as much a part of Tahiri as Tahiri is." Jag shook his head.
"I don't understand."
Lorin looked apologetic. "I'm not entirely sure that I do either, to be honest," he said, "although I suspect that my species has a greater affinity for outcasts and refugees than most people, having spent most of our history being either or both. Since Yavin 4, Tahiri has been set apart from everyone else by virtue of her experience and her knowledge of the enemy. Anakin accepted her, but then he died, leaving her alone. We know that the idea of family is very strong among the Yuuzhan Vong, so she might have attempted to attach herself to you,
Anakin's family. Ultimately, though, it wouldn't have been enough to keep her stable. What she needed, no one could give her, except herself. The Rin came to the side of Tahiri's bed and placed a hand on her forehead. If she registered his presence, she made no sign. The Shapers know what they're doing. When they set out to turn Tahiri into a Yuuzhan Vong warrior, they did exactly that.
But they failed to get rid of Tahiri, Leia said.
Gower nodded. Thanks to Anakin, she was able to come back, only to find that her mind was now inhabited by someone else, and that someone had no intention of going away quietly either. From Rena's point of view, Tahiri is the interloper. Tahiri has done little else but resist her ever since her reawakening. Unfortunately, it's a battle that cannot be won, and it's taking a terrible toll on her mind.
If it can't be won, Jaina said, then what are you suggesting we do about her?
Simple, the Rin said, turning to face her. We have to help them learn to live together. We must teach them how to become one. Jaina's incredulous laugh came out as a short, sharp bleat of defiance as she rose to her feet.
I don't think so.
Leia stepped forward to assuage her daughter's anger.
Jaina, no, Mom, she said quickly. Teach Tahiri to accept the Yuuzhan Vong in her? After what they did to her? After what they did to Anakin?
She shook her head firmly.
I won't let that happen. There has to be another way of removing Rena without harming Tahiri. There has to be.
Gower met her anger unflinchingly. There isn't, he said soberly, when her outburst had abated. Just as Bokkarins cannot integrate the Puek and remain the same as they were before, so, too, is it with Tahiri and Rena. Moreover, there is a similar urgency. The Puek and the Bokkarins had to work together in order to save the planet from the Syrook. Now Tahiri must work with the personality of Rena Quad to save herself from madness. Jaina opened her mouth to object, then shut it when her mother touched her arm. Leia could sympathize with her daughter. The idea that Tahiri couldn't be cured of the treatments the Yuuzhan Vong had inflicted on her did sound preposterous, but she also knew that everything they'd so far tried had failed miserably. Okay, Jag said. Assuming there is only one option, then how do we go about it, exactly? The curtain stepped forward. Like Rena, he said. My people have been cast out and ostracized from the place in which we feel we belong. It almost killed us, but as have many others in such situations, we found our own way to survive. We believe that the power of life focuses in the objects we surround ourselves with. Either inadvertently or intentionally, the things we gather reinforce who we are, making us stronger or, at times, weaker. In a balanced life, the internal and external worlds reflect each other perfectly. When a life is imbalanced, internal and external aspects must be adjusted accordingly. That's all well and good, Jag said. But again I have to ask, what do we have to do to help Tahiri? The Kurtzan native opened one of the pouches at his side. Reaching inside, he removed a small wooden totem, its carved surface worn back by time. We Kurtzan focus aspects of our lives' energies in items such as these. When our inner self lacks a particular aspect, we use these objects to bring ourselves into balance. Gower says that Tahiri had such an object in her possession, a silver totem that she produced at a time of crisis. Leia reached into her robe and produced the pendant that Tahiri had taken from her and Han's bedroom that night, just before she'd fled.
Is this what you're looking for?
She placed the silver pendant in Aritz's calloused hand. The tiny representation of Yun Yamka glared up at her, as though vowing vengeance.
Tahiri blacked out when she found this on Galantos. She blacked out again when I confronted her with it the other night in our room. She was also holding it when they brought her into the infirmary.
This is it, Aritz said.
He folded the pendant in one hand and closed his eyes. He seemed to collapse into himself for a moment. Then, his impression in the force changing in a way Leia had never seen before. She couldn't help wonder just what he was doing or what he was sensing. The pendant belonged to the Yuuzhan Vong, and they were invisible to the force, so there was no way they could have left any impression on the tiny statue. Unless, of course, the power of life the Kurtzen had referred to was something else entirely. With the attention of the room upon him, Aritza stood silently as if in a trance. He muttered something unintelligible under his breath, and clutched the pendant tightly in his grasp. In her life, Leia had experienced many strange traditions on many worlds. The Kurtzen's actions weren't surprising or outlandish, and they were meant well. But she didn't have the heart to tell him that they weren't likely to help. Clearly, though, Jaina wasn't so willing to accept the gift in the spirit it was offered. She kept staring at Tahiri, shaking her head. As if reading her thoughts, Gower stepped up and placed a reassuring hand on Jaina's shoulder. "I know how you must feel about this," he said. "But remember, while the personality of Rina is undeniably Yuuzhan Vong, she doesn't represent all that the Yuuzhan Vong have done these past years. If she can be accused of anything, it can only be of trying to survive." "I don't care," Jaina said. "She's still Yuuzhan Vong." "But she's a victim in all of this," Gower said, "just as Tahiri is." Jaina looked as if she was about to argue this, but the Rin cut her off. "Tell me, was Tahiri herself when the bomb went off?"
"What?"
"No. Rina had taken her over by then."
"Why?"
"So it was, in fact, Rina who created the force bubble. Rina who saved the lives of those in the stands above by staying close into the bomb where she knew she would have the greatest effect." The Rin's stare was piercing, and beneath it Leia saw Jaina's stubbornness flag slightly. "Is that the work of someone who deserves our contempt? Someone who deserves to be put down?" Jaina looked away from Gower, back to Tahiri's motionless body.
"So what are we supposed to do? Sit back and let Rina take her over?"
"We have a choice to make. We can either help both of them, or we can watch them both die." Leia felt the responsibility Gower was giving them like a heavy weight around her neck. He was asking them to do something potentially very dangerous. She knew about Anakin's vision of Rina as a dark force sweeping across the galaxy. And she also knew that the vision could well come to pass if Rina was released, with all Tahiri's knowledge of the Jedi to back her up. Silgal had once described one of the Yuuzhan Vong's other hybrid creations, the Voxen, as part of this galaxy and part of the Yuuzhan Vong's. If Gower was right, Tahiri would have to achieve the same state in order to survive, and there was no guarantee that she wouldn't end up as murderous and vicious as those creatures. But in the end, Leia had to have faith in Tahiri's strength and resolve not to allow Anakin's vision to come to fruition. Aritza's silent mumbling ceased, and he opened his eyes. Gower stepped aside as the Kurtzen approached Tahiri's bed. No one spoke as Aritza held the silver pendant with one hand and rested the other on Tahiri's forehead. His lips moved soundlessly. There was no response from Tahiri as the Kurtzen gently placed the pendant on her chest.
"Are you sure we should leave that there?"
Jaina asked a little anxiously. Aritza nodded. "It is traditional. It will help cleanse her spiritually." With that, Aritza bowed reverently over her, holding the moment with an indrawn breath, then finally exhaling and backing away. The sound of boots clomping along the corridor outside broke the sudden quiet of the room. Leia turned to see Han walk into the room, a look of some urgency on his face. "We've just received word from Luke," he said, stepping up to Leia without acknowledging the others in the room. "He says—" Han stopped, looking around the room, noting for the first time the people gathered by Tahiri's bed. "What's going on?" Leia was about to explain the healing ceremony that Aritza was trying to perform, but decided against it before she started. She didn't particularly feel like listening to her husband's cynical "sounds like mumbo-jumbo to me" speech.
"I'll explain later," she said instead, taking his hand in hers.
Han accepted this with a nod. I heard the Rin was here. Where'd he go?
He's right.
It was her turn to leave a sentence unfinished.
Well, he was.
My friend had no intention of staying any longer than he was needed, Aritza said, stepping forward. Before we arrived, however, he did ask that I give you this. The Kurtzen handed a sheet of flimsyplast to Leia. She unfolded it and read, with her husband reading it also over her shoulder. My apologies for leaving so abruptly. I received word this morning that I am required elsewhere. Part of my instructions was to advise you to travel to Anadax at your earliest convenience. You will be met there. When she awakens, please extend my heartfelt thanks to Tahiri for all she has done here. With gratitude, Gower. I am sorry, the Kurtzen said.
Don't be, Han said. It's not your fault. I was just hoping to ask him about Droma.
He took the note from Leia and scanned it again.
We'll be met there, he paraphrased. Does he mean by another Rin, by the head of the family, or by someone else altogether?
It's not really made clear, Leia said. Despite, or because of that, her interest was definitely piqued.
Isn't Anadax in the Minos cluster? Jaina asked.
Leia nodded.
It's not all that far from Baccarat.
Han looked concerned.
What's wrong, Dad?
Well, it's not exactly the best of places to be visiting. It's a tough place, filled with all manner of lowlifes. I just don't want anyone getting their expectations up that this trip will be some sort of romantic holiday or something.
Han, we had our first kiss in the belly of a space slug, Leia said. Believe me when I say that my expectations of doing anything remotely romantic with you have never been particularly high.
She smiled at her husband and was glad to see him lose his somberness and smile back. Then, placing an arm about her shoulder, he made to leave with her.
Come on, your worshipfulness, he said wryly. You need to talk to Luke before he goes off to call Ben.
Wait. She turned to Aritza. What about Tahiri?
The Kurtzen shrugged again. I do not know how long it will take for her to heal. It might be 1 hour. It might be a year. She might never heal at all. I am sorry that I cannot give you a definite answer. All you can do is wait and see.
Leia looked at the girl on the bed once more. She hadn't moved the entire time they'd been in the room. No, wait. That wasn't quite true, Leia realized. She had changed. The young Jedi's eyes were now closed, as though she was sleeping. What that meant exactly, Leia didn't know, but she hoped that it was a positive sign, at least.
Dream well, Tahiri, she sent into the quiet dark that was Tahiri's mind. Dream well and come back strong.
The small shuttle rattled out of hyperspace just on the border of the Cyruvi Imperium. Its holds were almost empty, as was its flight deck. In total, it carried 8 passengers. Only one of them was alive. Kundertal watched from the commander's station as the shuttle performed a cursory sweep of the space around it. He had changed its original setting shortly after leaving Baccarat, immediately upon assuming control of the ship. This was a destination he had visited just once before. The event that had quite literally changed his life had taken place not far away, in a small research base left behind by the New Republic during its extended offensive against the Imperium. Abandoned for many years, it had been easy pickings for someone looking for a secret operations center. The shuttle's scan picked up the station and a modified Fussen-class picket ship parked nearby. He set the shuttle on an intercept vector for the latter, broadcasting a pre-planned signal. A response came within seconds. The picket ship extended docking grapnels and, once they were near enough, mated the two vessels together. A booming clang resounded through the ship around him, announcing contact. Grunting in satisfaction, Kundertal climbed from the commander's chair and headed for the airlock, stepping over the bodies of the Pwek crew as he went. The stump of his severed arm had healed over perfectly, leaving a smooth patch of skin that was barely tender to the touch.
"I have been waiting," said the Cyruvi general, whom Kundertal knew only as
Athena. His words came in the Cyruvi language, which the makers of Kundratal's body had pre-programmed him to understand. "I came as soon as I could." Kundratal executed the smallest bow he could deliver without seriously offending the general. There were no guards in the bare stateroom, but he didn't doubt that he was being watched. There were complications. The thick black ridge that was Athena's eyebrows lifted in disapproval. "The Kiramak is dead," Kundratal reported instantly and without emotion. "I have its body on board the shuttle as proof." He didn't mention that the shuttle had originally been intended to deliver the body to Olhwek as a placatory gesture, or that he'd been forced to stow away on the craft in order to redirect it, and to survive. The general nodded his approval, his scent tongues tasting the air. "As long as this objective has been achieved, then everything else is unimportant. I must admit that I don't understand why you wanted this above all else," Kundratal said. "Your people regard the Kiramak as some sort of god. Surely killing it will cause chaos and civil war, more disruption than the Imperium can possibly withstand. You've spent so long rebuilding things. Why destroy them now?" The general's massive tail thumped the ground once, as if demanding silence. "You are not required to understand anything, human. You stink of lies." Kundratal nodded, averting his gaze from the general's stare. He'd heard too many stories about the persuasive powers of the Cyruk to risk being caught now. His HRD body might be physically strong, but it couldn't protect him against the many traps that might befall his mind. But his mind tripped on the general's words. How could Athena have detected the scent of deception when the tissue comprising the outer layers of his new body had been specifically designed to release scents identical to a natural, non-stressed human, no matter what his state of mind or what lay beneath the facade? The general had to be bluffing, he told himself dismissively. It wasn't, however, so easy to shake himself free of his sudden suspicions. The Cyruk didn't often bluff, after all. They were usually more direct in their approaches to and manipulations of what they regarded to be lesser species. And now that he thought about it, the superior olfactory sensors of his new body were picking up something odd about the Cyruk. He suddenly felt distinctly uncomfortable, wanting to leave there as soon as possible. Something wasn't quite right, and he didn't like it one bit. "I've met my side of the bargain," he said, glad that he had retained his sabacc face after the transfer. "Now, how about you?" "You have your new body. What more do you want?" "You know what I want. You said you'd refund half the money I paid for this body if I delivered you Bakara. I've done that, so now I'd like what you promised me." The general began to pace the room with clicking strides, his tail sweeping menacingly. "It is my understanding that Shui is no longer part of the Imperium." "It has been consecrated, and the Prek traitors have taken it for their own, no?" "Yes, and you can fight for it now. You can send troops without fearing for their souls." The general cut him off with a chopping gesture of one mighty arm. "You have not delivered your side of the bargain, yet you expect me to keep mine," he roared close to Kundratal's face, spraying him with spittle. Kundratal flinched, and the general straightened. "I am disappointed, but I can't say that I'm surprised. Your species is not known for its honor." Kundratal could feel his control over the situation quickly slipping away. "Listen, we're both doing a job here, and as you know, sometimes it's not possible to meet every expectation. I've taken you halfway there, as we have taken you halfway," the general interrupted. "You have your new body. You have your bottled soul. Surely that is enough." And maybe it was, Kundratal thought. With his mind safely ensconced in its new HRD home, he was free from aging and disease. He really could live forever if he was careful. With the right contacts, he could get his arm fixed, establish a new power base somewhere else, begin building himself up to where he had been.
There were thousands of opportunities in a galaxy this large. All he had to do was...
Kundertal stopped the thought in its tracks. What was the point of dreams without money to bring them into reality? Without money, he would never be able to replace his missing limb or buy new contacts. He wouldn't even be able to refuel the shuttle after its next stop. There was no point being immortal if you couldn't do anything. Or worse, if you ended up drifting through space, heading nowhere. "I'm not leaving here without the payment I deserve," he said slowly and firmly, staring the big lizard right in the eyes.
"No."
The general squared off and flexed his powerful muscles.
"Would you combat me for it?"
Kundertal felt the strength coursing through his artificial body. What were flesh and blood against polyalloy bones and enhanced biofiber muscles? If he could outfight a Jedi, then a Sairu should be no trouble whatsoever. Kundertal nodded.
"I will," he said, "and I will crush you as I would an insect."
The general laughed. "The hatchmate returns to destroy his mother. I'm serious." Kundertal clenched and unclenched his fists with a mix of anger and nervousness.
"Give me my money."
The general took up the challenge unflinchingly as he stepped forward, pinning Kundertal with his stare. With lethal deliberation, he said, "The only thing you shall get from me is death." Kundertal braced himself for the fight and suddenly found that he was unable to move. He was rooted to the spot, every muscle of his body rigid as though he were nothing more than a statue. He couldn't move his eyes, his mouth. He couldn't even breathe. And then, in mid-stroke, the beating of his heart stopped. The general's leering visage came so close that he could feel the alien's breath on his face. Twin scent tongues tasted him, licking at the fear surely emanating from his synth flesh.
"You are a fool, human," Athena said.
The general's breath stank, but Kundertal couldn't turn away from it.
"Did you honestly think that we wouldn't be ready for you? Do you believe us to be so stupid? We have learned much of your vile machine since coming to your galaxy. We know how to encourage your filthy technologists to perform for us, to build restraining bolts that activate on hearing a particular phrase. We are perfectly capable of stealing that which we require to reach our goals. Goals you helped us attain. You sowed chaos. Now we shall reap the rewards."
Kundertal yearned to pull away.
"Since coming to your galaxy..."
Panic flooded through him. The alien's hideous face seemed to melt and peel away. The long snout folded back and rolled down the long neck, taking the triple-lidded eyes and scent tongues with them. Beneath lay a face more horrible than any Kundertal had ever imagined. A long, sloping forehead swept down to two gaunt, tattooed cheeks. Purple sacks bulged under cold black eyes. Deep scars carved the gray flesh like the cracks of an ice moon, and sharp teeth grinned at him as he realized his mistake.
"You are nothing to me," hissed the voice of the impersonator. "Perhaps had you remained alive, we might have taken you as a slave or a sacrifice. But as you are worthless, unliving filth. We have destroyed the machine that made you and purified the hands that touched it with the blood of a thousand captives. We would never deign to deal with dead stuff such as you are now made of. Life is tissue, it is soil, it is blood."
The creature paused then and smiled.
"It is death."
The face that would be the last thing Kundertal ever saw pulled back out of range. So profoundly was he frozen by the restraining bolt, he couldn't even focus his eyes. Everything beyond a meter remained a blur that filled with dark shadows as more of the vile creatures entered the room. They swarmed around him, twisting and writhing in impossible shapes.
"The only thing you shall get from me is death."
So Athena, or whatever the alien's real name was, had said, and with those words he had been condemned. The last thing Kundertal felt was the powerful sting of amphistaff striking him and tearing his artificial body apart. He couldn't move, but the aliens had ensured that he could still feel pain. The agony was blinding, too much to truly comprehend. When Kundertal's containment fields finally dissolved and his mind fell away, it came as pure relief. In the end, there was just one. Classe Ephemera was an isolated system on the side of Chiss space, opposite the galactic core. Named after the explorer who had first charted the system centuries ago, it had once housed a small gem-mining operation around its one gas giant, a bloated monster hovering just inside the star's habitable zone. Severe atmospheric disturbances had prevented the gem station from ever being profitable, however, so it had been abandoned more than 50 standard years earlier. Classe Ephemera had lain fallow ever since, lacking terrestrial worlds that might have encouraged colonization. Too remote to warrant commercial interest, and yet too far away from the Chiss border to justify even a token military presence. Every few decades, an automated probe would sweep through the system to update astronomical charts and ensure that the navigational anchor points left behind by the initial survey were still true. Beyond that, it was completely ignored. And so it might have remained forever, had not the last probe to pass through some 25 years earlier happened to note that the sole gas giant in the system, Mobus, had acquired a new satellite. This satellite joined a family of 17 other satellites around Mobus, but exceeded their combined mass more than 10 times over. A world in its own right, it was shrouded in clouds that prevented a visual survey as the probe flew by. The presence of water vapor might have warranted further investigation, but the probe was not programmed to change course for something so nebulous. Had there been clear signs of intelligent life on the moon world, the probe might have braked into an orbit around Classe A and observed the new moon in more detail, then reported the findings back to its superiors in the CEDF. But the planet emitted nothing on the subspace channels, nor were there any transmissions on the electromagnetic spectrum. So the probe simply noted the moon's appearance, then continued on its way. The fact of the moon's existence had languished in the Chiss Expeditionary Library ever since, filed with all the myriad other reports from thousands of identical probes. As rare as the orbital capture was, it wasn't startling enough to attract the attention of the astronomers who studied the data on the probe's return. There were countless more interesting discoveries waiting in the unknown regions. So what if an abandoned system acquired an extra moon or two? Jason stared at the pictures of the moon brought back by the probe with a feeling bordering on profound awe. He saw a gray orb lit by the baleful light of a boiling red-yellow gas giant. The atmosphere soaked up infrared, but radar showed a hilly terrain around the equator, with several small flat spots that could have been seas scattered evenly across both hemispheres. There was evidence of recent eruptions and crust movement, as would be expected for a world that had endured capture, not just by a sun, but also by a gas giant. "That's it," he breathed, barely able to contain his enthusiasm. "That's Sonoma Seacoat." "The chart's listed as M18, Wynn said. "It's Sonoma Seacoat," Jason repeated. "It has to be. What did you say the odds were, Danny?"
"Very much against something like this happening naturally, Jason," she said. "But that doesn't mean it couldn't happen."
"I know," he replied easily, "but it didn't." R2-D2 whistled cheerfully, as though backing him up.
"We should at least check it out," Mara said.
"We will," Luke agreed. "After all, it's the best lead we've had so far."
"If there's anything we can do to assist you," Soontir Fell said, "consider it done."
He hesitated for barely a second before adding, "Within reason, of course." Those weren't empty words. The Chiss had already provided detailed tactical maps of the unknown regions, revealing several torturous trade lanes through areas that previously had been thought impassable. More sinisterly, the data showed that the Yuuzhan Vong had been more active in the area than Galactic Alliance intelligence had known. As far back as the first attacks on New Republic systems, a Yuuzhan Vong task force had made an end run around Chiss space and made it into the unknown regions. That it had never been heard of since, or that no other task force had made it past the Chiss, was no cause for complacency. Further Chiss assistance might well prove welcome at some point. Luke smiled genially. Thank you, he said, and I promise not to mention a treaty with the Galactic Alliance until the next time we pass through here.
If there is a next time, Mara said.
Jason nodded, thinking of the attack on the Imperial Remnant, the Krizlaws on Manmali Mafir, and Chief Navigator Abe. And then, of course, the Yuuzhan Vong themselves, whose incursions into Chiss space were becoming more frequent every day. It's been hard enough getting this far, he thought. I doubt it's going to get any easier. He felt Danny's support and confidence nearby, and was warmed by it. At least, he added, there was no shortage of support. For him and the Galactic Federation of Free Alliances. All they had to do was follow their hearts, letting the Force guide their decisions, and eventually, he was sure, they'd get there. What they would find when they arrived, however, remained to be seen.